Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Oh, do we have a busy day today? There's just so much going on. First of all, I just wanted to let you know that Iran does have nuclear weapons, and good morning. I mean, that's the title of the show today. That's kind of where we stand, because, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think about when North Korea got the bomb, and, you know, as we call it, the bomb, you know, and the Clinton administration did everything possible basically to give it to them. They paid them not to to get one, so, of course, they used that money and got one. You know, and the same thing with Iran. You know, you pay them not to get one. Of course, they use the money to get one. And so I've got a fascinating article here. And we're going to go over this in the second half of this hour. Just let me let you know just some of the folks that contributed to the article. And it's called Iran Probably Has the Bomb. Here's What to Do About It. And listen to the cast of folks. In fact, one of them includes Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who does our national security report at the bottom of the hour, 7:30 in the morning Central Time on Mondays. But James Wolseley, William Graham, Henry Cooper, Fritz Ermeth, and Peter Pry. James Wolseley is Navy Secretary, if I remember. Let me just scroll down here just for a little bit, because this is fascinating. And, here we go. No, he's former director of Central Intelligence, so that'd be the CIA. These are all the folks that know what's going on, as opposed to the Biden administration, which has no idea what's going on. And so that's why it's so fascinating, I think, to go over this. But anyway, we've got a lot to do with Shannon. Ooh, Shannon's lying back again. Shannon, if you can call right back, that'd be great. And then we'll get to her. But there's many things going on. And just to sum up from last week, if you didn't get a chance to hear my Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday show, in the second hour Monday and Tuesday, and Wednesday, it looks like I started a little bit early. So at the bottom half of the first hour, you know, proving that the vaccine for coronavirus came years before the coronavirus. In fact, I believe that the coronavirus was created specifically to market the vaccine. I'm not going to go into all that now, but go check out the shows last week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And if that doesn't scare the crap out of you, I don't think anything will, but just the whole idea of it. So just, you know, please, until they find out how these things actually work, don't get the vaccine. Don't even think about it. All right, let's get to Shannon, and I'll be right back. She served her country in the Air Force. She swore to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And now Shannon Rice serves on the City Council of Milton, Florida. One voice, unwavering, still supporting and defending the Constitution against a wave of emergency declarations, lockdowns, and unlawful force. And all in support of the rights of her constituents and all Americans. She is Shannon Rice, and this is the Rice Report. Well, it will be when she gets here. Got a little bit of trouble, I guess, with the phone lines this morning. So, Shannon, as soon as you can, feel free to call in. It'd be great to hear from you, and we'll get started. Let me just give you kind of a summary of what's going on. There was let me see where I'm going to go with my notes here. Where did I put them? Oh, this is no fun. Oh, this is great. I forgot to put them anywhere. So the things I do know about – oh, here we go. All right. So the first thing that I want to talk about with Shannon, they have this gun buyback program. And this is over in Pensacola, our crazy neighbors to the west. And so Escambia County is the most northwestern county in Florida. And we're like number two in line. We're the next in line at Santa Rosa County, then Okaloosa County, and that sort of goes from there. So Pensacola, who you think would know better, except they do have this liberal population, had this gun buyback program. Ah, there she is. Okay, good. So let me bring Shannon on here. And it always fascinates me, the idiocy of the left and this whole idea of buying back guns. Well, they're not buying them back. They're buying them. They didn't buy them in the first place. You know, the customers did, or they were stolen or something else, or who knows what happened. But the idea of a gun buyback is completely misnamed. So let's start there. Good morning, Shannon. How you doing? Oh, what's wrong with your phone line? I can't hear a word. There you are. Okay, go ahead. Okay. That's better.
Okay. I don't know what
And hopefully, how old's this time?
A little. Well, now I heard how is this time. So we finally got you. But yeah, I guess you're having phone issues this morning, which happens. You know, technical difficulties. I've had my own with microphones and various other amusements here. So
yeah, I'm trying to find a better signal. I don't know what the problem is, but I heard you were talking about the gun bypass.
Well, we'll start there. Then we got a couple of other things I want to cover this half hour too. They already heard the intro, but Shannon's on the Milton City Council here in Milton, Florida, in Santa Rosa County, again, up in the northwest corner of the Panhandle, for those of you listening around the country and around the world. Welcome. So, yeah.
So, you read about the buyback? And
I read about it. My old boss was there, too. Mike Bates made a great speech, and apparently he was interviewed, too. And Mike, in classic style, just totally trashed everything. It was great. It was great to listen to him, the absurdity of this whole thing. So, anyway, what's your take on it?
Well, did you see the pictures of that? Some of them were, like, homemade guns that were made with wood and pipe?
Wood and which? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Paid for them. Sorry. They were homemade guns, a pipe gun or something like that.
They were homemade? So they put like a little pipes on, like nailed stuff on there and made it look like a gun, sort of?
They actually functional. Oh. Supposedly those were sold there too. There's a couple different Facebook groups that were talking about that. And okay. Showed pictures even.
Oh, that's funny. See, now I got a much better signal. Okay, so I love this whole idea of homemade guns. Well, here's the problem with these things. You've got liberals that think that they're do-gooding, but they're actually not doing anything. And this whole idea of buying, guns to, quote, get them off the street. Well, what does that mean to you? In the Milton City Council, when you guys talk about gun programs, if you talk about gun programs, and it always comes up, well, we have to get guns off the street. What does that mean exactly?
I don't even say about it, because for me, I like for our citizens to have guns. I think a armed society is a more polite society. So I don't even want to discuss that at our city council.
Okay.
I don't think anybody
would
bring it up. I just don't think anybody would bring it up at our city council. They're much more conservative. Or if they did, I think they'd probably somebody sat down the street saying that they would pay more for the guns.
Well, what I'm thinking is they think that all guns are bad. And if they buy guns from people, there are fewer guns out there, because I don't think they can distinguish between criminals and law-abiding citizens. So for you and me, the idea of more guns, quote, on the street, in other words, concealed carry, open carry, that's a good thing. But for a liberal, more guns on the street, I don't even think they think about the criminals. I think they think about the law-abiding citizen, because those are the only people affected by their laws. So they must hate the idea that law-abiding citizens would have guns, quote, walking around on the street. It's not like the guns walk around by themselves, but I sort of have the feeling they think that too, that they're just guns out there. You're just walking down you're just walking around. Well, there's a gun sitting right there on the street. It's this bizarre concept that what they're really talking about is law-abiding gun owners who have them locked up, who have them secure in a holster, or have them at the target range or hunting, whatever. But to them, that all comes under this broad heading of on the street, and therefore every gun owner is a criminal. And I really think that's what they're getting to. So any gun they, quote, buy back, in other words, buy, is a good thing, even though the people are getting rid of the cheapest, non-working, broken, dysfunctional, guns. Or as Mike Bates said, he brought like $125 worth of guns and got, what, $450 for them or something like that. And most people who are doing this, they're taking the money, they're trading their old dysfunctional guns, they're taking the money and they're buying new guns. This is great. Anyway, Shannon just dropped off, so we're having a little trouble with her line. So I'll which is too bad, because I wanted to talk to her then. And so Shannon, call back. We'll get you back here. And then we have other things we need to talk about too. All right. So just a preview of what's going on. We're going to talk about nuclear weapons in Iran in the second half of this hour. And then after that, I don't know if Dr. Pryor is going to hang around for a while. You never really know. That's what makes it fun. We've got this thing going on. We had this Alaska summit, and it was a complete disaster. Let me give a little preview of our Alaska summit. This is what Peter Navarro said. All right. And Peter Navarro, actually, one of my favorite people, he's the one that has this entire election report proving that what we all know, that Biden's a complete fraud. So it's not just Mike Lindell. It's Peter Navarro, who I believe is also the person that reported to President Trump to let the quote pandemic run its course, get it over with as quickly as possible. And we would have been out of it in 8 weeks. That's what I think. Anyway, Shannon's back, so I'll get her back on the line, and then we'll talk more about this other stuff. And it's kind of, you're there, you're not there. You know, it's one of those mornings.
Yeah. Sorry about that. And so, okay. You were speaking about the gun buybacks and if it works, or mm-hmm. you know, and that. Rand Paul recently asked Dr. Fauci if his wearing two masks was theater, and that's what I think gun buybacks are. It's just theater. I don't think it does anything.
So, yeah, it makes you feel good, but
I'm not willing to vote in favor of tax dollars for that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, it is pretty stupid. I don't understand the logic of it. Other than, like I said, it's feel good. It's leftist. It gives you the impression that everybody's a criminal. And if we can just get some guns, we'll collect some guns. But how many guns are out there? You know, not just on the street, but didn't Americans buy several million guns this year already?
Well, and I would think that, you know, like for a felon that's not supposed to own guns, that if they do have one, that it's much more than $200.
Yeah.
So I just don't.
So they're buying the guns for $200. So in other words, you're a worthless piece of crap that, you know, it wouldn't be worth $20 at turning into getting $200. These people are idiots. Well, it's a government program. What do you expect? Okay. something else. Let's talk about some fun news. I saw a notice. The Magellan Cafe, was there one of the local reporters here? I don't know if it's WEAR, one of the TV stations, who does local features. You know, do you know about this place? Did you hear about this?
WEAR when I did not, but that's great. So it is a family operated new coffee piece.
Your line's fading in and out again. This is really frustrating because I know you want to talk about this. Try again.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. That's working now.
Locally owned, veteran-owned, family-operated coffee tea smoothie place that just opened. And, you know, we're a small city, so we only have one other place that's in a different direction, you know, if you're driving to work. So it's great, and it's a big deal for our little city.
Yay. Well, we need, you know, especially downtown, you know, in fact, there were some friends of mine that had a wonderful barbecue place across from the high school, and they left for another small town. I was wishing that the downtown could have made, you know, because they have the space for it, but I'd love to see a barbecue place down there too. There's another one of my favorite cafes, Mama Lattes. So we're doing shameless plugs all over. We don't care. It's our town. We can do that. So if you're listening in, you know, Bahrain right now, you know, come on down. Milton's kind of a cool place. But where is the Magellan? Where is that? I want to go visit them. Oh, she's faded away again. All right, so I'm going to look it up on Facebook. M-E-G-L-L-A-N Cafe. I can run the whole show myself. I'll just talk. We'll see what happens. Oh, here we go. This is interesting. All right. So I'm covering the features I wanted to, just not the way I wanted to. Let's give them a like. Magellan Cafe, their address here. Where you find you guys? I can't find their address. Come on, guys. This is no fun. Well, I guess Shannon Rice was there, too. They got nice little promos and things. I'll put it on my Facebook page because it looks like fun. Looks like a cool place. And, again, the more local places we can get. 6406 Highway 90. Okay. I'll find them. I'll post a map. We'll get them out there so you guys can come find it. I should do like a coffee tour. So what I'm planning to do for a lot of the local businesses around here is to do just that, is to do little videos from various places and let you know what's going on. I did one from the barbecue place. And I've done a couple of them. It's just been a while since I've done that. But there's another place, K&B Cafe. So give me a flavor for the town here as we go. All right. So I covered the Magellan Cafe. We covered the gun buyback program. There's a bill that Shannon had posted on her site as well. I want to get to that. And also, there was a great presentation, which I was not able to attend because I was exhausted. This was Saturday. Chris Ann Hall. Chris Ann Hall is a constitutional attorney and has been on the show. She was on a year ago, and she was talking about state powers. And one of the big things I'll be working especially with, and have been for a while, trying to broadcast ways that the states can resist, you know, our tyrannical federal government, our illegitimate federal government. We have an unlawful presidency. And so the states have to be able to do things. One of the things I quoted not too long ago was an article from 10 years ago on states have the power to protect their own borders. That is perfectly constitutional. In fact, the states can do anything that, as far as police powers go, that is not specifically delegated to the federal government. And in fact, it turns out that even immigration, which we thought was specifically a federal responsibility, is not totally federal. And that citizens of the states, you know, deserve the protection of their state, and then that includes their state borders. And that means not letting illegal aliens in. And so we'll talk about that. But you were at the meeting last night with Chris Ann Hall. Can you tell me a bit about that? I was really curious what it is. I'm going to see if I can find a recording of that so I can post that as well. But what'd you all talk about?
Well, her focus was on where the power in government is, and it's with the people, and that we need to be involved and, you know, not elect people to just, and I'm not using her words here, but this is what she's talking about, not having other people just handle it for us, that we need to stay involved, and we need to make sure we're telling our elected officials what we want. And, you know, talked about the peaceful protest, and it was just very good, very motivational for people to stay involved and get involved and speak up.
Okay. So, I'm seeing some notes here. I want to talk to her again. Let's see if I can get her back on the show. The whole purpose of Action Radio is not only to get involved and to tell their elected officials what we want, but to actually supply them with the laws that we want passed. And I mean, I sometimes feel a conflict because, I mean, it comes from the show. I mean, I work with a lot of the bills. I mean, obviously there's probably too much of me in it. This is why I try and do it by consensus to get comments and things like that. But the things that I'm writing and other folks are writing are going over pretty favorably with most conservatives, independents, libertarians. And so I think we're on the right track here. So what I want to do with Chris Ann Hall is say, not only are we getting involved, we're way beyond getting involved. You know, we are actually reversing the direction at which legislation, you know, flows. Normally it comes from lobbyists, large corporations, greedy individuals, George Soros's, extremist wacko groups and things like that who have tons of money, and they're the ones who are supplying the legislators with, you know, both the bills that they want and the campaign funds to get reelected, okay? So that's hard to fight. So we as citizens come along and say, okay, we're going to, instead of having the legislature dictate the laws to us, and the only voice we have is an election, we're actually going to write the laws ourselves that we consent to be governed by, submit them to them along with all the other nonsense bills that are coming from the special interests, and say, look, we're an alternative source of legislation. We are not only, you know, involved with the elections, but we're so involved, we're actually writing the language of the bills that we think, you know, are the best way to govern us. And Josie's on the line too, so take her call too. But yeah, go ahead.
Some of it was the focus on getting involved with your local government, you know, which is relevant as we speak here, because it makes me so happy that in the city of Milton, we've proven that works. You know, our citizens are really good as far as about showing up at city council meetings and sending in emails and demanding that their city council act in the way they want them to. So I love that.
I have you on every week. The whole point of having you on is to be in. I'm sorry, go ahead. We're both talking. Yeah.
Yeah. So I need that interaction. I want that interaction. I'm always doing posts asking for it. So I'm there to carry the word of the people. Unfortunately, not all elected officials are there for that reason. Some of them seem to think that they make the best decisions.
See, that's arrogance. That's the arrogance of power. So feel free to post the fact that you're on this show every Monday morning at 7 o'clock and see if we can get some more interaction. Speaking of interaction, let's see what Josie has to say about Chris Ann Hall last night and anything else. Good morning, Josie. Welcome to the Rice Report.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Shannon. It was nice seeing you and hugging you. I did give her, Greg, I told her that I was with Action Radio, and
cool.
She told me to please call her. She said,
okay.
I'm ready. She said, whenever you want to have you back, he said, call me, I'll be back.
Okay.
You know, so she's ready to go, and like Shannon said, it was very, very informative, and very few people had a mask on, but most of them did not have a mask in the building.
Excellent.
And yeah, her main point was for us that we have the power as the people of the United States. And it is so important, like she just said, to get involved locally at this local area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what
we need
to do.
Well, and it's interesting. We're involved locally, but we're also involved, you know, statewide, nationally, and internationally. You know, and I hope to be the conduit for citizen legislation worldwide, you know, as we set up a center for citizen legislation. And we teach not only our local folks, you know, how to do what we do, which is a total reversal of the legislative direction. From the people to the government as opposed to the other way around, but that we can also, you know, work with folks at the state level, at the national level. And as we take this to, you know, England probably first, and Canada and Australia, you know, the English speaking world, and then we work on the rest of the world, you know, so there's an incredible future here. And I'd love to have Chris Ann Hall, you know, help us out because she's brilliant. She's wonderful. Yeah. Go ahead, Josie.
And one important thing she asked, she said, raise your hand if you have a pocket constitution with you. And a lot of people, including myself, raised our hand.
Hmm.
And then she goes, do you have a Florida constitution in your pocket? And nobody had it.
Interesting.
And she said, that is the most important thing that you need to know, your laws of your state. Bottom
mm-hmm.
line. That's it right there.
Well,
yeah,
the
she talked a lot about how that
we, ahead,
that we are sovereign states, that we are not colonies, and that we need to be mindful of that.
Hmm. Is there a recording of this anywhere that I could post? What do you think?
I don't know.
Did anybody make a recording?
I don't think we're making
a
recording.
Huh. I'll check our website just in case. That sounds like fun.
But she did
you know,
give the 554. She gave 55444 for you to type on your text and then type the word liberty. And you can get some free information, like a study, a little taste of what she does. So
okay. We
did that.
Well, I can pull up her website. Let me see if I can pull up my Facebook page real quick. And that's Chris. That's KRISANANNE Hall. So, okay, this is right here. Then we can go back talking about the Magellan Cafe. We never quite got there. I want to know where it is, too. Yes.
What we need in Milton is a little Cuban restaurant.
Sounds good to me.
Too, makes a lot of money.
Yes.
If anybody can open up, it would be great. Cuban Cafe.
Yes, we do need that. We do need that.
We got too many restaurants. We got too many Mexican restaurants everywhere, but we don't have any Latino food at all here unless I cook it.
Wait a minute. So the Nicaraguan says there are too many Mexican restaurants and not enough Latino food. That's a classic,
Josie.
Well,
there's none. Chico, there's none. I mean, I eat Mexican once in a while, but we don't like that type of food, you know? It's okay, but we need some Spanish restaurants. Like arroz con pollo, and, you know, they eat a little different than we do, so.
Oh, okay. We need to do a food show. See, now, the reason that Shannon and I are kind of cracking up here is you know, in basic Western American philosophy, you know, Latino includes Mexico, Cuba, you know, it's like you're all one big group, all right, which, of course, is nonsense. It's like talking about Africans.
Yeah, but they eat different.
You know, and Pianki reacts to that because of like Nigerians and Kenyans and Ugandans and everybody else like that. But it's just, it's the mindset that we all get. And, you know, I'm just as guilty as anybody. So when you talk about, you know, we need more Latino food, not Mexican, I'm sorry. That's funny.
No. I like Mexican, but once in a while. But, you know, there's nothing like Cuban or Colombian or anything at all. The only thing you have is on 9th Avenue. It's Mr. Pollo, like Mr. Chicken. And it's like Cuban a little bit, but that's about the only little tiny place that you have Mr. Pollo.
Okay.
And they have good chicken and black beans, right? Because the Mexicans don't cook black beans at all, you know.
Hang on, I'm getting I gotta end that page.
Sophie, if you're down in Navarre, if you're down in Navarre, you should swing into JJ Chago's. I would think that they're still open. They were very popular. It's on Highway 98.
Well, what can we do about our small town here in this center of the historic district here? We've got space. We've got places for businesses to open. I'd love to be a mecca for international food. I mean, who would have thought that the downtown basically Mayberry RFD of the panhandle, you know, we should be a place that we could bring in these things. We've got this big courthouse that's going to be abandoned. I don't know if they have to keep the building or not, but we could fill that with Cuban and French and, Ugandan. And then, you know, we could put any kind of food there on the planet. It'd be fascinating. We'd have our own little gourmet place right here in the historic district. We got the river, get a riverboat tours. You know, we could have gators and, Colombian. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, the possibilities here are so incredible. And this is what we talk about. We talk about, you know, local stuff. So all those folks listening, go, why are you talking about Milton? You know, you can do this in your town. Okay. There's no reason why, you know, Peoria can't have, Eritrean food. There's no reason why, you know, Arkansas, pick a town, you know, Little Rock can't have, well, they probably do it because it's a big city, but you know, why can't they have Mongolian food? You know, I mean, the beauty of San Francisco, the one thing I loved about it is the fact that you had literally food from all over the world. You know, in fact, they even started combining things. I remember this one place that was half Indian restaurant, half Irish pub. I swear to God, this is true, right? It was on my tour. All right. And the fun part about that was, you know, you could get a Guinness with your tandoori chicken. All right. So then you start mixing the cultures. I think it's really interesting, you know. So I mean, that doesn't, maybe that's not so good. But the point is that there's another place, Carlos Murphy's. You know, it was an Irish Mexican restaurant. You know, see how they corned beef and tacos, you know, and the funny thing is that we can mix these things. And just when the cultures get together, I was listening to something on One American News. Talking about the resegregation of America. And so, you know, I don't get too big a topic now because we only have a few minutes left. Dr. Pryor's going to, you know, we're going to sort of really get you with the nuclear weapons story with Iran. But the point is that it's the Democrats who are always resegregating. They're always segregating the country. And they were talking about how Brown versus Board of Education, you know, the decision that was written by Earl Warren, who was a conservative Republican. It's like the Republicans try and unite everybody and the Democrats try and segregate. So we need to be able to, to come together and go, we can take all these things. We can take these, you know, and food is a great way to do it. Food is a, you know, culture is a great way to sort of have everybody mixed together. Go, isn't this great? This is fun. But not separate, but recognize the differences, but still be united under the fact that we're all Americans. And so I think we could do a great service here by bringing as much culture to Milton and towns all across this country. Bring culture to your town from everywhere. Who cares? This is America. This is what makes us great. You know, and so the Shannon,
Greg, nowadays the Democrats say that cultural appropriation.
Well, that's segregation. You know, that's just another word for segregation. You know, white privilege is another word for segregation. You know, race, critical race theory is segregation. That's all they do. They've been segregating since this country was founded. I mean, the Confederacy was Democrat. The Ku Klux Klan was Democrat. The filibuster for the Civil Rights Act was Democrat. The separate graduations that are going on today, the critical race theory, the white privilege, the white nationalism, the white supremacy, it's all Democrat segregation. We need to stop that. So cultural appropriation, I'm not appropriating somebody else's culture. How can I? I'm a white guy. I've got white guy culture, okay? I'm proud of it. I like my white guy culture. All right. Look what we've done. The computer, the car, the airplane, you know, exploring, you know, places around the world. White guys have done a lot of good stuff. I'm proud of that. So how am I going to appropriate, you know, female Latino culture, Latina culture, excuse me. How am I going to do that? Latina. Exactly. So Josie, is there any way that I could appropriate your culture? How am I going to do that?
Yeah, you can learn. I can.
That's different. But appropriating means stealing, means taking, means taking over. So if you think about this, you know, in its illogical stupidity, is there any way that one person can take over another person's culture?
Well, the Democrats are doing that.
Well, they're separating cultures.
I think you know,
but
stealing everything.
But, yeah, but if I, you know, well, if I eat Cuban food,
I always thought
go ahead.
That to emulate was to honor. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, if I want to do my hair a certain way or wear certain clothes, it's because I like it and I appreciate it. It isn't anything mean.
Yeah.
I've never
well, that's the difference
bad,
between
but...
celebrating and appropriating is a negative term. It's a derogatory term. Appropriation leads to cultural segregation, which is what the Democrats are all about. So I need to stop this nonsense. Wow, we're on a roll today.
Yeah,
this
there's
is
a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, anything else we haven't covered? I mean, like I said, I'm expecting Dr. Pryor any second
no.
To fill us full of stuff.
It was
okay.
a beautiful, beautiful day yesterday in the city of Milton, and people out, lots
yeah.
of things to do. Spring, everything's blooming. Just getting,
yeah,
you
spring
know,
break.
A little, yeah, so I think the beaches were busy this weekend, this past week, and everything too. So it's a great time to be in Florida.
Sure is. So are we, just before I get to Dr. Pry, who's now on the line, do we have a spring break? Are there any restrictions? Are the beaches open and the pubs open and the restaurants open and the B&Bs open? Is there anything that people have to worry about? Or are we back to business as usual, I hope?
Well, I haven't heard of anything. If it is, the businesses, I think, are doing it on their own.
Okay.
We've been back to business as usual for a long time.
Yep.
Here in Florida.
Party on, Jen.
All right. Call you later. God bless you guys.
God bless, Jesse. Thanks
and
very much.
Thank you. God bless you. Right. And our economy has shown that. So I'll let you go. You have a good day.
All right. Thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Jesse. Let's get on to our national security report, and I'll be right back. What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. So this week we have time to cover the status of Iran nuclear bombs, and that is an incredible article you sent, you know, with James Wolfley, William Graham, Henry Cooper, Fritz Ermath, which I think you've talked about him before, and of course you. You guys wrote an incredible piece for National Review, which I posted a couple of times. I posted it when you first sent it to me, and I also posted it today for folks for reference. So I'm just going to turn it over to you. What the hell is going on in Iran?
Well, thank you so much, Greg. We think, the title of the article is Iran probably already has the bomb. And we wrote a similar article to this 5 years ago, but decided it was time to update it because we've been just extremely disappointed that the intelligence community and the Washington establishment mainstream view of the Iran nuclear threat hasn't changed in 5 years. Even though the evidence continues to pile up that Iran probably already has the bomb. And when I say the mainstream Washington view, I'm not just talking about the Biden administration, the mainstream view of the Democrat Party, but this has been the longstanding view of the Republican Party too, which just sort of slavishly goes along with whatever the intelligence community tells them, even though the intelligence community has been wrong about almost everything. Especially when it comes to the nuclear weapon programs of other states like North Korea, that they got very wrong.
Why are they so wrong?
Underestimated that threat.
I mean, you think they get it right at least once just by chance. You know, they're wrong. It's almost like they're intentionally wrong, which is, I think we've talked
yes,
about.
Yes, it is almost like they're intentionally wrong. Well, I think there's a number of reasons for this. When I worked in the CIA many years ago, between 1985 and 1995, which I thought was one of the most interesting times to work there because it was right at the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, I saw the Soviet Union at the height of its military power when it was the greatest threat to the West, and then its decline, and then the rise of Russia, you know, and the new nuclear threat from Russia. And then, you know, left during the Clinton administration to go work on the House Armed Services Committee as professional staff. And I saw a process of politicization. That is to say, what that means is the ideology and wishful thinking, politics, starting to interfere. You know, there's a couple of mottos outside the headquarters, the CIA headquarters. One of them is Veritas, which is truth in Latin, and another is the truth will set you free. So the purpose of the CIA, and when I went to work for it, you know, it was out of academia, where also the commitment was supposed to be to truth, to the facts, you know, getting to the facts, you know, not twisting the facts to support the wishful thinking of whichever administration happened to be in power, and particularly Democrats, okay? And that, I could see that had been happening over many years, and it got worse under the Clinton administration, got really bad, you know, and accelerated far to the left under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. But I remember, to just give an anecdote as an example here of the kind of thing that was happening, and this is in the Clinton years when it wasn't nearly as bad as it became under the Obama administration, but the Cold War was over. I'm giving a long-winded answer to your short question.
No, I think okay. You can. No, that's okay. We got time okay. Today, so let's expand on it. Yeah.
But here's just an anecdote. This is an echo of what happened to me. The Cold War was over. The Clinton administration wanted to deeply cut the defense budget so that they could spend the money on domestic spending to build the economy and grow the economy. And not only would make that better for the American people, but it would guarantee, if they could have a booming economy at the expense of the defense budget, it would guarantee President Clinton's reelection. And part of what they also wanted to do, you know, was deeply cut the intelligence community budget. And since the Cold War was over, at least as the Clinton administration view of these matters, And the Soviet Union was gone, and Russia was going to be, at those times, they were thinking it was going to be our strategic partner, that we could really reduce investment in following the nuclear threat, too, from Russia. And Clinton was afraid to do that on his own, and just as commander-in-chief, directed that be done. He wanted the support of the intelligence community to do that. And so a person from the Clinton administration came over, tips of CIA analysts, including our group, and they wanted everybody to say, you know, yeah, we agree with that. We think that that's the smart thing to do. You know, if the president does that, we're all right with it. And they knew that I would not say that, you know, because my view and the view of a number of others who worked in this specific area of the Russian nuclear threat, you know, said that, well, the Cold War may be over for us, but the Russian general staff, actually, it's not over for them, and it's not over for the Russian intelligence community. They think the Cold War is going to continue, and in fact, they think that the threat from the United States is even worse than it was in the past, because now Russia's on the ropes. And if they were in our, if the roles were reversed, and we were on the ropes, they would finish the job. They would finish the job. And they're expecting us to finish the job. That there's going to be a nuclear World War III right around the corner. So we can't afford to take our, especially if we're cutting the defense budget, you know, cutting the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, cutting our nuclear deterrent, we need to increase our intelligence budget to keep a sharper eye on these, to compensate for our weakened military posture that the president has in store for us. That was my position. A lot of people in the agency actually believed that, but almost all of them were afraid to say that to the politicians. And I remember my boss's boss's boss having me in his office and telling me, you know, you're a great analyst. I don't want to lose you. You know, please keep your mouth shut. Just go along with this, okay?
So that's so stupid.
And I didn't.
I didn't
go along with it.
Yeah.
I told him what I really believe, because I believe in Veritas. I believe in the truth and the facts. And they sent me into, what was it? The boss over my boss, the top person who ran, you know, it was then the office of, called of Eurasian and Russian analysis. Lady named Christine Williams, as a matter of fact, you know, who didn't know anything about ICBM. She was a person that was in there with the new Clinton administration and had gotten that job through the political influence of the Clinton administration. And she was furious with me, and she wanted me basically sent to the analytical equivalent of Siberia.
Yes, in Greenland, yeah.
She wanted to pull me out of studying Russian nuclear weapons and strategy and have me retrained as an economist and shipped off to Indonesia to literally count rubber plants in Indonesia, okay?
Wow.
Fortunately, I had a lot of powerful friends, real intelligence analysts, you know, the people like the chairman of the NIC, Fritz Ehrmacht, okay, you know, who stood up for me and basically said, no, we can't afford to lose this guy. We're not going to let you do that. And a compromise was made, and I was sent to, what did they call that? Interpersonal relations classes. Yeah, to try to teach me how to be more deferential and to supposedly, you know,
as a result
of that.
I saw Hunt for Red October. I watched Alec Baldwin be, you know, totally defiant, and it worked out well. So it works well in the movies, but in real life, they really don't want to know the truth, do they? If it goes against the agenda.
They don't want to know the truth. They want you to, well, yeah, I think that's the case. And I think this case with Iran is an example of that. They don't want to know the truth, you know, because they knew that no administration, and this is true of the Republicans too, you know, it's why North Korea, for example, you know, has managed to become a nuclear weapon state right under our nose. You know, no president wants a country like North Korea to become an existential threat to the United States on their watch. They would much rather have the problem disappear by having the intelligence community cover their rear ends and say, well, they're not there yet. They're not there yet. They still, you know, we still have time to negotiate and engage in sanctions behavior, sanction them economically, and derail their nuclear program. We have time. That happened with North Korea. As an example of how they grossly underestimated it, they're still actually underestimating the North Korean threat today. But as late as the spring of 2017, you know, the intelligence community was basically arguing that, well, you know, North Korea is experimenting with missiles that could have ICBM capability, but we still think they're years away from getting an ICBM. And we think that they're at least a decade away from getting a hydrogen bomb. That was in the spring of 2017. And then by the end of the summer, a few months later, by the end of the summer of 2017, North Korea had demonstrated both ICBMs that could strike any state in the United States, and they tested a hydrogen bomb successfully.
They read our intelligence analysis.
Right, yeah. Which the North Koreans, by the way, also described as having a capability for super EMP attack, okay?
Yep.
So they were, the intelligence community was off by a mile. And it was after that, hydrogen bomb test that we had, you know, we went into this very serious nuclear crisis, you know, where President Trump and North Korea were engaged in not just an escalating war of words, but the North Koreans were launching missiles over Japan, threatening to strike our carrier group.
I remember, yeah.
And it put the president in the embarrassing position. This is my theory of what happened, okay? But I think the facts bear it out. It put the president into the embarrassing position of having to switch gears very rapidly from going from calling, deriding North Korea and its leader as Little Rocket Man, to meeting with Kim Jong-un and trying to smooth, put oil on the waters to defuse, to de-escalate the nuclear crisis, you know, which both people on the left and the right have criticized the president for doing that. And I didn't like to see him do that either. But I think the intelligence community, you know, basically put the president in that condition, into that position by their persistent lowballing of the North Korean threat. And then when it couldn't be denied anymore, you know, we ended up with this very serious nuclear crisis. I mean, General Mattis was sleeping in his running outfit, you know, and had command and control links in his bedroom and following him in his car just in case we ended up having to have a nuclear exchange with North Korea. Hmm. And all of that happened because the intelligence community was telling the administration, has told every administration, including the Trump administration, what they wanted to hear, or what they thought they wanted to hear, you know. And even to that today, they're still lowballing the North Korean threat, some of them. Well, this isn't so much the intelligence community. The intelligence community after that, you know, basically, I think has conceded that North Korea is actually, you know, arrived where it can attack the United States.
But
there's some propaganda that's still out there. There's some propaganda that's still out there that started with the Obama administration. In 2013, mm-hmm. there was this technical argument when because North Korea at that time, you know, had orbited those a satellite, you know, that was the KMS-3 that we've talked about before, that
right.
could be armed for a nuclear EMP attack, all right? But Obama didn't want to admit that. And so this new argument was introduced as to, well, why aren't they a nuclear threat yet? And it has to do with the reentry vehicle, that they haven't demonstrated that they can deliver a nuclear weapon through the atmosphere, you know, and actually hit a city with a reentry vehicle. Yes, they've got the hydrogen bomb. Yes, they've got atomic bombs. But do they have a reentry vehicle? And that argument, you still see that popping up, especially in the liberal and left-wing press, that, well, there's still time to negotiate with North Korea because they haven't perfected a reentry vehicle. And that is just a lie, you know.
That's a rationalization.
That's not a significant.
Not a fact.
It's not a significant technological impediment. You know, a reentry vehicle is really easy to build, you know, compared to building a hydrogen bomb, compared to building a multi-stage ICBM. You know, the technological challenge of a reentry vehicle is nothing. Besides, every missile they've got, we've seen them on display. Every missile they've got up to the ICBMs have demonstrated reentry vehicles. You know, you don't actually have to test a reentry vehicle. You know, somebody with a slide rule, a decent engineer, you know what the speed of the vehicles has to be. You know the kind of temperatures it's going to encounter and the accelerations and decelerations it's going to encounter. You could develop a reentry vehicle just with a slide rule and knowing basic engineering principles without actually having to test it. So, mm-hmm. you know, this is
the formulas, right? For gravity,
especially.
Yeah. Aren't there formulas for everything now?
The arms control community especially clings to the reentry vehicle theory like a lifeboat, you know, because they want to argue, oh, there's still time to negotiate, you know, a treaty before North Korea really goes nuclear. And that's very dangerous thinking. At some point, you know, you've got to admit, look, North Korea is a nuclear weapon state. They pose an existential threat to us. You know, we've got to deal with that problem, you know, and not live in the hope that they still haven't solved the reentry vehicle problem. Therefore, I'm not going to think of them as a nuclear threat. You know, that's a very dangerous thing. And unfortunately, you know, you've got people like that who have an arms control orientation, an ideological problems, because they've come out of universities, especially in the CIA. You know, these people tend to be coming out of our universities. And so they have all the attitudes that you would expect from Harvard University and Yale, you know, people who are have been brainwashed into thinking that the United States is the problem in world affairs, and also people who are basically not dedicated to truth as much as they are dedicated to telling the administrations what they want to hear, particularly Democrat administrations. You know, Trump was so unpopular, but particularly Democrat administrations, because they envision themselves as, you know, they Republicans and Republican administrations are, even Ronald Reagan, when I was serving in the agency, even then, you know, Reagan was, they had cartoons festooned all over, you know, the tank, the classified secure area where we would work. You know, a lot of people, nobody had cartoons mocking Brezhnev or any Democrat or Democrat political leader, but Reagan was widely mocked, and they really hated his idea of Star Wars. That was derided, you know. Even back then, during the Clinton years, you know, the agency had already become deeply politicized. And that's why they don't see the Iranian nuclear threat today, or at least one of the reasons, you know, because the Obama administration tells them that the official position of the Obama administration was, well, they don't have the bomb yet. That's what the president wanted to hear, and that's what they told him. That's what they were telling everybody. Otherwise, you know, if Iran already had the bomb during the Obama years, then what sense would the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action it have? You know, the JCPOA, that was supposed to be President Obama's biggest foreign and defense policy win, that he had saved us all from Iran, you know, the mullahs, the ayatollahs, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the world's biggest and most sophisticated terrorist organization. He had saved us from them going nuclear, getting a nuclear weapon. And that's why, you know, he bent heaven and earth, you know, to try to, you know, gave all that money to basically turned his back on Israel and the moderate Arab states and tried to bent over backwards to make nice with Iran to get them to sign up to the JCPOA, you know, because that was supposed to be the acme of the Obama administration's foreign and defense policy achievement. But none of it, of course, all of it is just a farce if Iran already had the bomb. And so I think that's one of the reasons why, the chief reason why the you know, intelligence community has become so politicized that you know, that they don't want to admit Iran has the bomb. And there's other reasons too.
I know I might have been cutting you off. I've got a few questions I want to ask you, especially about the article, and I want to kind of focus in more on the actual bomb itself and some different things. But we got time. We can go over today, so we're not really restricted.
Sure.
And then after that, I want to talk about Alaska and the complete failure out there. So if you have some, I know you have a perspective on that too. So feel free to stick around for a few minutes, and we'll end up with Alaska, and then I'll get on a couple articles I want to talk about on that. But if you want to finish,
good.
Then I got some stuff for you. Yeah.
Yes, there are some other assumptions that are built in to the way the intelligence community thinks about nuclear proliferation that are technologically and politically untrue, but that they regularly assume these things, and these false assumptions end up accounting for why they're wrong over and over again on these matters. And I think these assumptions, it also has to do with the politics of it. You know, they like these assumptions because it enables them to not have to give bad news to a president. But one of them is, you know, you can't count a nation as a nuclear weapon state until they've done a test. They have to do a nuclear test in order for you to count them as a nuclear weapon state. And that's just not true. You know, as we point out in the article, You can develop a nuclear weapon and not test it and have high confidence that it will work. This was true with the first atomic bombs that were built by the United States. You know, we developed in just three years two different kinds of atomic bomb. One was called a gun design, and it was fueled by uranium, and the other was a plutonium design that had a more sophisticated implosion design. we only tested the implosion design, and we only tested that once, you know, and it worked perfectly. The gun design, you know, was such a simple design that even in the 1940s, you know, when nuclear weapons technology had gone from being merely theoretical to reality in merely 3 years, nonetheless, our scientists had such confidence in the gun design that they didn't test it. Hiroshima was the test, and it worked. Obviously, it worked perfectly, tragically, but it worked exactly the way it was supposed to design. So even the United States, we should know from our own experience, you know, that a nuclear weapon state doesn't have to test. You know, they can just do component testing. Also, the hydrogen bombs in our current arsenal, you know, we've been patching them together for 30 years and haven't tested them. And they're really not the same weapons that they were 30 years ago. You know, because a brand new weapon, just like a car, okay, you know, you can drive a car out of the dealer, place, and you've got a brand new car. 30 years later, you know, you've changed a lot of parts. You've changed parts in that car, but in effect, you haven't been able to drive that car for 30 years to test it. And we have high confidence, or at least the mainstream view in the U.S. government, I don't have high confidence, but the mainstream view in the U.S. government is that, well, we can have high confidence that those hydrogen bombs will work because we do component testing. Well, that same logic can apply to Iran or North Korea or these other countries. You know, Israel is never known to have tested its nuclear weapons, but it has a very sophisticated arsenal. And India and Pakistan, you know, when they finally tested nuclear weapons in 1998, they did a whole series of tests, and they were a range of weapons, including very sophisticated weapons, including neutron bombs. India is supposed to have set off a couple of neutron bombs during the 1998 tests, which meant that they had been building bombs of varying designs for many years before the 1998 tests. The 1998 tests by India and Pakistan weren't out of technological necessity to actually test the weapons. The Indians and Pakistanis had confidence that the weapons would work. It was done for political reasons, you know, because Pakistan had a crisis, and Pakistan to threaten India set off a test, and India replied. And every time the Pakistanis tested, one the Indians did, and that's why that happened. So this idea that you must test a nuclear weapon by exploding it and demonstrating yield is simply false. You know, and that's probably what we believe has been done in Iran, that they don't need to test and that they have done component testing. And if they did feel they needed to do testing, they have a very close relationship with North Korea. You know, there are reports that Iranian scientists have been present at every North Korean nuclear test. For all we know, some of those tests might have been of Iranian weapons. In fact, the design of North Korean weapons and Iranian weapons might be exactly the same because they have a treaty to share scientific and defense technology information. And it's such a close relationship that North Koreans are actually in Iran. We don't know how deeply they go, but we know for sure that North Koreans are working with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard on their so-called space program, you know, which is covered to develop an ICBM. So that's one of the big myths out there, that the intelligence community, one of the big mistakes they make, well, we can't count Iran as a nuclear weapons state until they test, you know, and that's part of the reason. Another thing is the assumption that Iran's nuclear weapons program is indigenous. That's a phrase the intelligence community uses to describe indigenous, a program that has to rely virtually 100% on the scientific, technological, and industrial resources of Iran itself, that they're not getting outside help from anybody. But as I just explained, they are getting outside help from North Korea. They're also getting help from Russia, China, and probably Pakistan. And the help is not subtle. I mean, Russia has built Iran's nuclear reactors, and they're in the process of building more nuclear reactors. And even the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is not a good nuclear watchdog, even they have uncovered you know, evidence that Russian nuclear weapon designers have been in Iran helping the Iranians. The IAEA, that's another one of the so the idea that Iran's program is indigenous, you know, is another excuse for claiming that the Iranians don't have the technological and industrial sophistication, you know, to build an atomic bomb yet. Although I have to say that even the liberals don't argue that anymore, not anymore, because the mainstream view in Washington is that Iran, if it wanted to, it could build a bomb in a year or less. You know, so they clearly, so even they at this point concede, yes, if they wanted to, they could build a bomb. But here's another one of the contradictions in their position. They've been taking that position for at least a decade, that Iran for the past decade has been within 1 year of building the bomb. And the only thing restraining them is Iran itself, that Iran for some reason, you know, would decide, well, we're going to refrain from building atomic weapons and do so for a decade. You know, that's just such an implausible theory. The intelligence community also, I think that this helps them in their bureaucratic political effort to attract money and to have Washington rely upon them, basically argues, or at least the mainstream view is, that if Iran moves toward building the atomic bomb, the intelligence community will be able to prevent it, you know, or see it, because they watch the Iranians like hawks, and they will see it, and that will give us an opportunity to exercise emergency measures, maybe military measures, to stop them from getting the bomb. Now, that is a real false assumption, okay, because the intelligence community, as I noted before, has had a terrible record at being a nuclear watchdog. In fact, the intelligence community isn't the nuclear watchdog in Iran. I don't know, you know, mainstream Washington doesn't seem to understand that the only way our intelligence community gets to look at Iran is through satellites. You know, we don't have boots on the ground. You know, our people don't have access to any of these Iranian facilities. Our intelligence community, just like everybody else, has to depend on the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's the UN nuclear watchdog. And they are even worse than our own intelligence community. They're nuclear watchdogs.
Like the World Health Organization?
Yeah. I mean, the IAEA was supposed to be the nuclear watchdog on North Korea, on Pakistan, right, on Libya, on Iraq. I mean, all of these countries had clandestine nuclear weapon programs, and the nuclear watchdog, that is the IAEA, didn't discover any of them. You know, they were going on right under the IAEA's nose. And it's really nonetheless, you know, even the IAEA, even as incompetent as they are, they've still come up with some really compelling evidence, you know, about the Iranian program that, you know, if you just that evidence alone, that Iran probably built nuclear weapons years ago. But for some reason, people, maybe it's because of technological ignorance, but people just can't come to grips with that. Because another point in our article is, you know, we know from the International Atomic Energy Agency reporting and from other sources as well, that prior to 2003, you know, the Iranians were already manufacturing neutron initiators and bridge wire detonators, and they had designed and successfully tested an implosion device. And they were also working on the design of a physics package, that is the nuclear weapon. They had worked out 19 different ways of putting together an atomic bomb that could fit inside the reentry vehicle, the high explosives reentry vehicle for their Shahab 3 missile, which at 2003 was their most sophisticated missile. Now, when the United States was and during our Manhattan Project, you know, during World War II, when the United States was just dealing with, you know, 1940s era technology, and the possibility of a nuclear weapon was only theoretical, you know, we were able to build the first atomic bombs in just 3 years. And in our program, in the Manhattan Project program, when we were making neutron initiators and bridge wire detonators and had designed an implosion device, in other words, when we were in the Manhattan Project at that same stage that Iran was in 2003, we were only a few months from getting the first atomic bombs. You know, so it's just strange credulity that Iran would voluntarily, you know, why would they just stop and not clandestinely finish that bomb? It doesn't make any sense. You know, a prudent military planner here in the West should assume, well, they must have clandestinely finished those bombs, and what they're probably doing is building up an arsenal of nuclear-armed missiles. Not only do we think they've got the atomic bomb, but they've probably at least developed a warhead for the Shahab-3 medium-range ballistic missile. And they probably have a satellite, a nuclear-armed satellite, like North Korea has, that could be orbited over the United States at a time of their choosing when they needed to do that in some kind of a crisis. The Iranians have shown us on occasion, given us glimpses on their own TV into these vast underground missile facilities, you know, for their Shahab-3 and other other missiles. So we know they've got this vast underground missile launch capability. And we also know that they have a number of underground military industrial facilities that belong to the military that the IAEA is not allowed to inspect. That's another myth that's out there that's very widespread. You know, people who want to argue that Iran doesn't have the bomb say, well, we've got the IAEA in there looking at their program. They're looking at the civilian program. They're not allowed to go into any of the Iranian military bases, which is probably where a parallel military program continues. And one of the pieces of imagery we have seen that we mentioned in this article, and it was available to the public, it's not classified, but there's an overhead imagery of a vast military underground complex with high voltage power lines. You know, there's dedicated to this. They go across the desert. You know, they look like 500,000, 750,000 volt high power voltage lines, and they go from a generator, and the cables go underground into this facility. What are they doing in that facility that requires a half million? In fact, there's like four of these high power lines. So it's, you know, actually multi-millions of volts that are going into this underground facility. You know, there's not many things that require that amount of energy. One of the things that requires that amount of energy is centrifuge arrays for enriching uranium to weapons grade. You know, they could have thousands, probably do have thousands of centrifuges in there. And that's where, so these constant reports about, you know, well, this is how many kilograms of enriched uranium, you know, the Iranians have got that are enriched to 5% or 20%, you know, are just totally untrustworthy, because those are the IAEA estimates of the civilian program. You know, we don't know what they're doing at these underground facilities. They probably have been able to manufacture vast quantities of weapons-grade uranium, probably plutonium, over the last 18 years, you know, to arm their underground missiles.
Yeah. But I want to start to bring you back in here. I got a couple of questions, and I think we really get. I know you love the technical, and I'm fascinated by it too. But I want to kind of make it more accessible for the general folks that are listening. One of the things you're talking about is this crossover between civilian and military. And I think people, you know, don't really realize that a nuclear power plant and a nuclear weapons lab have a whole lot of things in common. I guess they call that dual use technology. And it's not that hard to take, you know, uranium that's used, you know, at energy grade, I guess you would call it, for a nuclear power plant. And when you talk about enriching it, just as I understand it, just for the folks out there that are new to all this physics stuff, you're taking a heavier U-239 atom, which is 239, I guess, neutrons, and you're separating out the good stuff, the U-235, which is much more volatile, much more explosive, and use what they call a centrifuge. So as I understand it, centrifuge, the heavier objects go to the outside. It spins really fast. It sends the atoms out there. The heavier ones are on the outside. The ones that are the lighter ones are on the inside. That's the U-235. So enriching actually is increasing the concentration of the U-235 uranium. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's exactly right, and that's how a gaseous centrifuge works, yes.
Right. So it's not that hard to do. I mean, a centrifuge is just the thing that spins stuff really fast, right, if I can put this in the simplest terms?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, the hardest part is the earliest part, because as you correctly described it, you know, there's less than 1% if you get a natural chunk of uranium, it's like 99.9% U-239, you know, which is not what you need for a weapon. You want the U-235.
Yeah, and, still powerful, but...
And only in a tiny, tiny fraction of that lump is going to be the U-235.
Right.
And the U-235 and the U-239, they're so close to each other. I mean, the difference is only, 4 electrons, that they're chemically indistinguishable, so you can't use chemical processes. You know, you've got it's only that slight difference, the weight of 4 electrons, that's the difference. And it's the fact that the U-235 weighs a little less than the U-239. And that's why the heavier stuff goes to the outside. But you can imagine the difficulty and it takes millions of cycles or many thousands of cycles anyway in order to get something from being natural uranium, you know, where you've got this very low mix of U-235 up to 5%, okay? And that's what the Iranians had done under JCPOA, that they were allowed to do to enrich up to 5%. But, once you're at 5%, you've solved 99% of the problem, because 5% is actually a big number, and it doesn't require that many more cycles to get it up. That's why, for example, Iran recently, you know, to put pressure on the Biden administration, said, well, you know, you guys are violating the JCPOA. You know, you've pulled out of the JCPOA, and you've still got sanctions on us, so we're going to punish you by starting to enrich uranium to 20%. And they're already enriching uranium to 20%. And they can do that quickly, you know, because it's not that hard to go from 5% to 20%. And it's not that hard to go from 20% to 90% or more, which is what the so-called weapons grade is. But that's another technological kind of myth.
I want to get away from the technology again for a bit here. Here's how it looks.
Okay, sure.
No, you're brilliant. I love what you're saying. We got some time constraints, and I want to sort of focus in on just giving people an overall picture here. So here's how I think the game is played. I think the game was played this way with North Korea, and I think the game was played this way with Iran. They both want to go nuclear. All right. So if I were an intelligence analyst, I would look at the fact that they want to have nuclear power, because what nation doesn't? So I would assume that that's the goal of every nation, if they can, to have nuclear bombs, prestige, defense, for whatever reason. And they want to do that, but they want to pretend that they're not, or at least they want to pretend that they're going nuclear and they won't go nuclear if something happens. And that usually involves, you know, billions of dollars of cash from us. So Clinton paid North Korea billions in cash, Atoms for Peace, or whatever that program was called.
Agreed framework.
What was it called?
It was called the agreed framework.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I was present at the creation of the agreed framework too, and told them what a farce that was. But that's another story.
So here's the thing. So then Iran has the JCPOA, has the Obama agreement. So the thing is, they say, well, we won't go nuclear if you pay us, knowing full well that you and I know that they were going to go nuclear anyway. And so they take the money that they were being paid to not go nuclear and use that to go nuclear. That seems to be how the game is played.
Well, I'm sure it helped their nuclear program. But mostly
they were going to do it anyway.
Mostly what they used that money for. They could have gone nuclear without the money that the Obama administration was giving them. But certainly, I'm sure they used some of that money for the nuclear program. I think they used most of that money to expand their geopolitical and strategic interests in the Middle East, mm-hmm. because during the Obama years, Israel and our allies, the moderate Arab states, were back on their heels. You know, that was the period of the great expansion of Iranian power into Iraq, into Syria, a big increase in international terrorism, you know, which is what which is what the Islamic Revolutionary Guard does, spending a lot of money to also build up their conventional forces and their missile, their missile inventory. But yes, I mean, you know, if you're saying that arms control, these arms control treaties that entail trying to bribe them with money actually makes mm-hmm. the situation worse. Yes, it does. But it makes it worse, not just in terms of increasing the nuclear threat that we're trying to stop, but mm-hmm. also it shifted the balance of power in the Middle East so that Iran was well on the way to becoming the dominant power in the Middle East as a consequence of those billions of dollars that we put in there, that the Iranians were using to fund international terrorism, both in the region and internationally.
Okay. There seems to be also a perverse logic about this, that we do everything we can, or at least we say we do, to not have a nation go nuclear. We have nuclear non-proliferation, I think it's called. So once a nation does go nuclear, this kind of inverse logic takes over. It's like, if they're nuclear, what can we do about it? We just have to live with it. So they do everything possible, you know, on the front end, knowing full well that they're probably going to go nuclear anyway. But once they do go nuclear, there are no consequences for it. Does that make sense?
Well, I would disagree with the part where you say they do everything possible. You know, the one thing that they could do that would make a difference, or at least that we could do that could make a difference, we never do. And that is, we never to this point have exercised the military option to stop them from going nuclear.
Okay.
And we could have done that. Israel has done that twice. You know, Israel exercised the military option because it didn't want Iraq under Saddam Hussein. They saw Iraq, you know, had a nuclear program. And so they attacked the Ashuric reactor and wiped it out and set back the Iraqi nuclear weapons program by a decade. When North Korea was building basically a nuclear bomb factory for Syria, in the desert, the Israelis didn't tolerate that either. You know, in fact, the Israelis they follow a completely different pattern than us. The Israelis didn't go to Saddam Hussein with their hat in their hand and offer him money and beg to have international negotiations, you know, to give him a high profile, and basically crawl to him on their hands and knees and beg him to stop the program. No, they just made a surprise military strike and took the program out. And the same thing with Syria. And, Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad, those guys are bad guys just like Kim Jong-un. They're evil people, you know, just like Kim Jong-un. And they don't like to get attacked either. And they also have chemical programs, and they have the ability to strike back, okay, and do a lot of damage to a little country like Israel. Why? Mm-hmm. They want to be alive. You know, they knew that if they retaliated using any kind of weapon of mass destruction against Israel or did assassination attempts against the Israelis would do it right back, and they wouldn't be alive. So that works. Yeah. Israel has demonstrated that works. But for some reason, our Pentagon, isn't as courageous as Israel. And even though we have a lot less to fear from these bad actors, especially when the programs are nascent, you know, before they get ICBMs that can reach the United States, we never ended up doing it. And going back to that agreed framework as an example, the author on this article, Jim Woolsey, he was my good friend Jim Woolsey, who, in my opinion, even though he's a Democrat, you know, was the best director that the CIA ever had, because he's willing to speak truth to power and not tell these guys what they want to hear. And Jim did that. Jim Woolsey did that in 1995. He told the Clinton administration, And he didn't keep it a secret because he was concerned that the Clinton administration wasn't going to do anything. But he testified before the as the director of the CIA and the top at that time, that was basically the equivalent of being the director of National Intelligence too, because the CIA director is also what they call the director of Central Intelligence. You know, and so he's the top, our top intelligence officer in the United States. And he testified to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committees in 1995 that North Korea had the bomb. They probably had a couple of bombs at that time. They didn't have missiles that could reach the United States. They hadn't probably hadn't weaponized it yet so that it could be delivered against South Korea or Japan by missile, but that they probably had a small number of atomic bombs in 1995. And that was just, you know, when Bill Clinton was elected. And the question then became, well, what are we going to do about it? And I remember having conversations with Gary Seymour, you know, who was the big non-proliferation guy in the White House, and I was on the professional staff representing the House Armed Services Committee at these meetings. And the Clinton administration was, you know, very reluctantly thinking about, well, military options. You know, are we going to have a war with North Korea? You know, because everybody knew it was, I thought everybody knew that it was unacceptable for North Korea to become a nuclear weapons state. Even the Clinton administration seemed to get that. And it looked like for 6 months that we were moving in the direction of possibly doing what Israel would have done, okay, and taking out that nuclear program, killing it in the cradle before it got, you know, even worse. But about 6 months into that, we had had a meeting with Gary Seymour, I and other staff, and he said, you know, oh, a miracle has happened, words to that effect. You know, we've had a breakthrough. You know, the problem is solved. You know, we've been negotiating, and we've got this thing called the agreed framework with the North Koreans, and we think that we can persuade them, you know, by giving them food and money and fuel oil and building more nuclear reactors for them. Part of the agreed framework, people forget, wasn't just bribes by giving them material and financial support, but we were actually supposed to build more nuclear reactors for North Korea.
Yeah, that's the part, that's the crazy part.
I mean, that's basically, yeah, exactly. It would have increased by tenfold their bomb-making capability if we had built those nuclear reactors. And so we're not going to have to, this is going to solve the problem, you know? And I told
them. That's the game. That's what Gary, I remember the game.
Yeah, I told him that is not a solution. You know, you're going to be making matters worse. They're going to cheat on this thing, and we're going to end up with an even more serious nuclear threat from North Korea than we face today. But, of course, it all fell on deaf ears, and the rest is history.
Well, the problem is we have no deterrent. We have a nuclear deterrent to a nuclear war, sort of. It's old. We've talked about that. But we have no nuclear proliferation deterrent. There's nothing that we are willing to do to stop a nation from, quote, going nuclear. This is why I say that, you know, we will talk about it. We'll talk a brave game. But once it happens, there's really nothing we intend to do about it. And that's the part that these nations all know. Iran knows that. North Korea knows that. So we can talk about it all we want. So there's no loss to them to try and, you know, force us to, you know, pay them money to not go nuclear when, of course, they want to go nuclear because every nation does, because who doesn't want that kind of power? You know, and they play this crazy game, and they know it works because our people in intelligence are so stupid that they're thinking, oh, we can bribe them out of not going nuclear. But if they had a brain in their heads, self-interest. I'll look at just, I mean, I'm not an intelligence-trained person, all right? Just basic self-interest. If I had the chance, you know, to own a more powerful car or some wimpy little Yugo, okay, or something made in the former Soviet bloc, I'm going to take the powerful car because it's in my interest. I want that, okay? So why wouldn't anybody who craves power, that's what politicians do, that's what leaders do. I don't believe there's a leader on the planet that wouldn't have nuclear power if they could. So, and that's just a basic, you know, layman's interpretation, just looking at power, you know, as everybody wants it. You know, everybody wants a better life, right? That's why everybody's coming here. It's the same kind of thing. Why would you ever assume that a leader didn't want a nuclear bomb? That to me makes no sense.
Right. No, I agree with you. And,
okay, good.
You know, I mean, there may be some exceptions, okay? You know, countries that have had ruinous experiences in war, like Japan and Germany, you know, are a couple of the most anti-nuclear countries on the planet. And they have populations. They have large political parties that are anti-nuclear and would oppose them getting the bomb and all the rest. But you're right, when they, I think when it comes to the political military leaders, you know, they quietly, you know, they themselves, if they could get away with it, you know, they would have and not pay a domestic political.
But we're also protecting those countries too. We're protecting Germany and Japan. They're allowed to be non-nuclear.
Where Iran is concerned, it's just interesting to see the very different directions those two countries took. You know, North Korea milked us through the agreed framework, you know, for as long as they could. And then when the Bush administration came along, they were more realistic. And they said, you know, they're cheating on this agreed framework. And so we're not going to be paying the money anymore. We're going to start levying sanctions on them. And that, in 2006, is when they tested. And ever since then, the Democrats have blamed President Bush for making North Korea go nuclear by ending the agreed framework, which is totally standing the real story on its head, you know. You know, they had already gone for nuclear in 1995. They were going nuclear, building more weapons during the Clinton administration. And the Clinton administration was just trying to maintain this fiction that the agreed framework was working. It didn't work. It never worked, you know. So, you know, Bush at least took that realistic step of saying, you know, this is not working. We need to do something else. But even the Bush administration didn't have the courage. You know, they were distracted by the war on terrorism and the rest. But frankly, maybe that's making excuses for them. You know, our own Pentagon, even under Trump, you know, under so-called Mad Dog Mattis, you know, could not be. They were deterred, you know, by attacking a nation that had already achieved nuclear missile capability. Understandably, that's a very risky thing. Nonetheless, just as an aside on this, I remember William Perry, who was a respected strategic thinker, on the Democrat side during the Bush administration, you know, criticized President Bush for not launching a preemptive strike on the North Korean program. Once the Democrats were out of power, I found that really ironic. You know, once the Democrats were out of power and it was now on Bush's lap, the North Korean threat, he was being egged on by one of their leading strategic thinkers to do the preemptive strike, you know, to stop them now. And Bush didn't do it. I think he should have listened to Perry. I think Perry was right. But then, remember, Perry became Obama's Secretary of Defense. And then when Perry was Secretary of Defense and he had the chance to do it, he didn't do it either. You know, it's unbelievable.
The boss didn't want to hear it.
I don't know if it's that because the Pentagon is such a big bureaucracy that when you put people into a collective herd type thing, and that even our military guys are so brainwashed to fear nuclear weapons, you know, that they, risky and it's dangerous, but it's far riskier to let somebody like North Korea, you know, develop the capabilities that they've got today, you know, as late as 2017,
from Hitler?
I think it would have been possible. I think it would have been possible. There was a realistic military option. You know, I think with three aircraft carriers, I wrote an article about this.
I remember.
Three aircraft carriers that we probably could have in a few hours eliminated at least that part of the North Korean nuclear program that threatens the United States directly. You know, we could have gotten their ICBMs, their medium range, their intermediate range ballistic missiles. We could have taken out the nascent submarine program and taken out their bombers. You know, we wouldn't have been able to completely disarm them because of the Nodong missiles. You know, they have hundreds of those. They're a mobile missile. We don't know how many of them are armed, probably only in a small fraction, but they'd still have retained the ability to pose a nuclear threat to our allies. But at least the American people wouldn't have had to have lived under the nightmare of a nuclear threat from North Korea if we had acted in 2017. Even now, it might not be too late. You know, I don't know. There have been
Biden's not going to
do leaks, the leaks on how many ICBMs, mobile ICBMs North Korea has got. have kind of stopped. You know, maybe that's due to the political pressure under the Trump administration. Where,
well, did Trump threaten them?
They
stopped testing when Trump took office. Did he threaten them? Did he threaten to do exactly what you're saying, to do a preemptive strike on their military? That, is there something we don't know about this that went on in the Trump administration
that you
can tell me?
Oh, he did it on television, basically. I mean,
okay.
He was warning. He was warning. Yeah, you know, there was the famous big stick analogy, right? Where Trump said, you know, you guys think you've got a big nuclear stick, but my nuclear stick is even bigger, and the press made a lot of fun about that. North Korea had threatened to strike our B-52 bomber wing in Guam,
right.
And that was a crisis point where not only did the president threaten, you know, to strike them if they even dropped missiles anywhere near Guam, but mobilized our forces and sent forces into South Korea, into Japan, aircraft. We did have the three aircraft carrier groups. I was actually hopeful that Trump might do it. You know, I happen to know that Newt Gingrich sent my article to the White House, you know,
okay.
You know, that kind of explained it. So I was hopeful in 2017 that during that crisis, that finally an American president would have the same kind of courage that Israel has shown in the past and kill the nuclear threat in its cradle, you know, before it could get more advanced. But I also know there was just a lot of criticism. The Pentagon was just very much afraid of escalation, you know, that would they be able to get they were particularly concerned. They were concerned that because North Korea has got, you know, this vast chemical and biological weapons stockpile, and it's got thousands of artillery tubes that can deliver chemical weapons, nerve gas, you know, against Seoul, you know, the largest city in South Korea, and they were really concerned that North Korea would escalate to doing that if we did a preemptive strike using conventional weapons, even if it was a surgical strike, that Kim Jong-un would escalate the situation. Now,
but he could do that anyway.
Sure, he could do that anyway. And Israel, when it had to make its calculations about Saddam Hussein and mm-hmm. Bashar al-Assad, it also had those same concerns, you know, because it's also under the gun. But it didn't happen, you know. And, you know, because those guys, even though they're evil and even though they're psychopathic, they're not suicidal, you know. Surely Kim Jong-un would have known if he did that it would be all over for North Korea. You know, if he started doing that, we might even go nuclear, from happening, including taking out his political military leaders. If we had the guts to be willing to do that and to threaten that, you know, I think we would have been in a much better situation today, and the American people wouldn't be living under a nuclear threat from North Korea. Our allies still would be, because I don't think we could have gone that far. But the other thing is that they weren't even willing to do this. One of the military options I had suggested, and that I still suggest that somebody exercise, it could be done by this administration. How about at least taking out those two North Korean satellites? You know, you're not attacking North Korea itself. The satellites are probably the biggest threat North Korea has got to us, you know, this new EMP attack. Take out those satellites and then say, you know, we're sending you a message here. You know, we're not going to tolerate you launching any more satellites, and we are seriously getting ready to take out. We're not going to let you build up an existential threat to the American people by being able to destroy our cities, you know, with blast and radioactive fallout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is your last chance to negotiate with us. We're willing to do great things for you to help you build your economy and all the stuff that President Trump promised. But if you don't take this advantage, we're coming after you. No American president has ever delivered on the threats, you know, and demonstrated that we have the political will to actually push back militarily and take a military action. This would be a very low-risk military action that we could take that would show that we're deadly serious about not letting them get the bomb. And we haven't even been willing to do that. But it's
I'll
an
tell
option
you what the
that's
objection
available
is.
To this administration.
I say what the weenies are going to say. They're going to say, but what if we miss? We'll look weak. We can't take the chance. That's what they're going to say. You know that, don't you? I mean, I can say it right now.
Well, we won't miss. I mean, we've taken
well,
out satellites before. We've taken
okay.
out our own satellites using an Aegis guided missile cruiser. So,
well, let's
you know, and
let's
we've got the
about...
national missile defense. I mean, if
yeah.
we couldn't take out those satellites with the national missile defense, we're in even worse trouble than I think. And you know that I'm
okay.
a pretty harsh critic of, you know,
well,
of,
let's make
of
a
our
target
military
practice.
Preparedness.
Let me talk
exactly.
to our congresspeople.
Great target.
Yeah.
It would be
good
great
exercise.
Target practice.
Yeah.
And it would eliminate the biggest threat that North Korea probably poses to us. And the other thing is, I think it would rattle the Russians and the Chinese. You know, the reason North Korea is the big nuclear threat that it's become is because they're a gun in the hands of China and Russia. China and Russia, the North Korean nuclear threat is built on their technology. They want North Korea to be a nuclear weapon threat to the United States, a growing nuclear weapons threat to us.
Mm-hmm.
You may notice
that
the Russians and the Chinese, they never complain. They're not, and North Korea never threatens them. You know, they have no problem with North Korea's nuclear. The fact of a nuclear North Korea strengthens their hand internationally because
yeah.
we're constantly crawling to the Chinese and the Russians, begging them to join us and to help us convince North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. And
this
of course,
makes us look
we have
weak,
to pay
though.
A price to them too, not just to North Korea. We end up paying
weak.
Prices to them too in exchange yeah. for their diplomatic support against North Korea. But I think if we shot down those satellites and for once, you know, got up on our hind legs and acted like we meant the military solution, the military option is a real option,
yeah.
You know, it might rattle them. It might make them more cautious. They might say, well, you know, we've gone as far with this game as we can, and we're now on the verge of pushing the United States into military action. So maybe we should just pocket the diplomatic victory and the political and economic victories that we've achieved up to this point, and do something to appease the United States for a change. You know, we're constantly trying to appease them and appease the other side. Let them have to appease us by them giving something up to appease a United States that finally isn't going to let its people face an existential threat from North Korea. And by the way, the same thing is true of Iran, which is what we're talking about. The Iranian nuclear missile threat is built on technology from North Korea, China, and Russia. They are another experiment by these bad actors. And the more North Korea gets away with, I predict in the future, you know, we will at some point probably see Iran go overtly nuclear. They haven't done it so far because, as I explained in the article, you know, Iran has gotten a lot more out of threatening to go nuclear than it
yep.
than it would if it overtly went nuclear.
Yeah, once
you
it's
know,
nuclear, what do you do? It's too late then. I wanted we've only got about 20 minutes left on the show. This has been fascinating. This has been great. This is why I wanted to extend our chat this morning. But I want to talk about Alaska for a little bit, and we can get back to this, you know, if anybody else has questions. If anybody wants to call in, this is a great time to do so, 215-383-3832. But it seems to me, and I want to talk about Taiwan in the coming weeks too, because that's going to be intertwined with this. But China, we just had the most, as I'm reading, the most horrendous summit up there. We look completely weak, which is, I don't think the Biden administration could pull off blowing up those satellites. I wish Trump had done it, but he was so distracted with COVID and impeachments and all kinds of other stuff. They ruined his administration. They didn't really let him do, you know, much of anything except, you know, play defense. And maybe it can happen again if he comes back, or the next or if we get a real president like Trump who's more confident in terms of his own personnel. But what happened up in Alaska? Are you familiar with some of the real flaws that we had? And where do we stand now? I think we look really weak, again, even weaker than we did before.
Oh, I agree with you. I do
okay.
I do think we look really weak up there. You know, bottom line is that we didn't get anything. You know, we made all kinds of assertions. In fact, they schooled us in Alaska, Biden people up. And also when you think of the kind of people, you know, Tony Blinken, for example, you know,
who's he? I've never heard of him.
He's nobody. I mean, you know, he's somebody who has dabbled in foreign policy and diplomacy. Yes, he had positions in the Obama administration. It doesn't help that he also has aspirations to be a rock star, you know. They're children. From the point of view of China, you know, China is serious about its national security people, about its diplomatic people, and they put serious, hardline people out there to meet with us and deal with us. They perceive our people as dilettantes, that they're not well informed, they're temporary political actors, you know, serving this senile president, you know, at this moment. They see us as weak. They saw our representatives as weak. And that's why on our own territory in Alaska, they were willing to school us about how, lecture us, you know, about how wicked our society is and, the bad things we've done to the Indians and to minorities in our own country. In other words, taking the left-wing rhetoric.
Left-wing propaganda.
Biden usually uses to lecture against us and basically said exactly the same kinds of things back to them up there in Alaska, telling us to get off our high horse about the Uyghurs and international trade and all the rest, and that they're not afraid of us. They're willing to go toe-to-toe with us in any kind of a contest, whether it's economic or also basically singing the praises of their own system. I mean, China has sort of taken the gloves off here. It used to be in the aftermath of the Cold War that socialist and communist totalitarian authoritarian systems, you know, were supposed to have been proven inferior to free systems. You know, it was the end of history, remember, the Francis Fukuyama book. You know, no more. You know, it sounds more like the 1920s, you know, where free systems, us, you know, have to defend our legitimacy against so-called superior totalitarian and authoritarian systems that have that take a scientific approach, as they describe it, that they have a better understanding of history, a scientific understanding of history, read a Marxist-Leninist interpretation of history, you know, which is supposed to be based on a science approach, but also based which means a more scientific approach to objective scientific approach to economics and to human nature. And that, too, is a theme that we constantly hear from the Democrats in this country, that all their decisions are not based on ideology. They're based on science, right? You know, whether it comes to wearing masks or their economic decisions, it's science-based. And that's basically exactly how they were lectured by the representatives from China. You know,
yeah, but their science
is not really.
All the science is based on ideology. This is a contradiction. You know, climate change is a completely ideological conclusion that they try and create science to verify. All this, the arms control, is an ideological conclusion that they try and make agreements to match. They're always doing this backwards. You know, nuclear nonproliferation is an ideological goal that they're willing to pay billions of dollars to get, and the other countries are like, yeah, we'll take your money, build the nukes anyway. It's a house of cards. They have no idea what they're doing. Which leads to a question I've been sort of thinking about for a while, and that is leaders. You know, when we create, you know, the people that went to China, for example, and why they went to Alaska, I don't know, other than to get away from the D.C., you know, reporters, because I don't even know who was up there covering this thing. But the thing is, our leaders, we've got literally a senile president who's not even president. It's an unlawful administration. You've got a bunch of liberal hacks from the Obama administration coming in. These people are not trained. They're not do it for life. They don't do anything. They're just kind of appointed, all right? And as you were saying before, the woman that wanted to send you to the equivalent of Greenland, she was a political appointee. So it's like you've got these professional bureaucrats at the lower level. You've got, you know, folks in the intelligence community that actually study this stuff. But you've got the people over them are just, you know, the current political hack from the current political administration. Now, China doesn't do things that way. If you can give me some insight into, like, how Xi Jinping, for example, got to where he is. Was he, you know, raised from birth to be a leader? Was he groomed for this? Did he rise up? I mean, how many people did he kill along the way? Did he have to prove himself? Because I think my feeling is that the Chinese folks that, you know, once you become a diplomat, that's your job. You know, if you're going to be a leader, that's your job. You know, and they keep it for life. That the people in the military, that's their job. They don't transfer around like we do. So how does Chinese leadership get to be Chinese leadership from what you know?
No, you're exactly right. That's how their system does work. You know, there are career paths, and you are and you are set on those career paths, you know, at a very young age. You know, oftentimes it's what your fathers did before you, okay? So that means that you follow that career path. But all of these things, you know, China, like all totalitarian systems, is a lot like, you know, those Star Trek episodes about the Klingon Empire, you know, where it is extremely competitive, and not in the sense that competitive means in this country where it's taking tests. It's the competition of life, because there is violence within these systems.
How many people
they are
killed
on violence?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't know how many people Xi has killed,
killed.
I'm sure he's killed some, or have arranged to have some killed, right?
Yeah.
Or sent to prison or whatever, the functional equivalent of destroying somebody else's life. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of that. That's one of the disadvantages we also have, by the way, because we're an open book. As a free society, we're an open book. They are not an open book. They're a black box. You know, we don't know their biographies all that well, or what goes on internally in the black box that the Chinese Communist Party, except that we do know that there is a lot of every now and again people disappear, you know, who were high profile. They go to prison, they disappear, they have their lives ruined, often are executed or assassinated. So violence is definitely a part of their system, just like it is with Russia or North Korea or Iran. All these authoritarian and diplomatic and totalitarian systems operate in that same way. And that while we would not want to live under a system like that, you know, one needs to respect, you know, one needs to respect like a rattlesnake, or like one would respect the mafia, okay, in dealing with these people, that they are not stupid, you know, they are ruthless, very ruthless, and are willing to do anything to achieve their goals, you know, which is not the case with us. You know, it's like sending in our team, you know, it's like sending in these, you know, some graduate students from Harvard who've been engaged in gender and feminist studies, and sending them in against the China's A-team, you know. What do you think the outcome of that negotiation is going to be?
I think it's not
going to be good for us.
Yeah. Well, here's kind of a totally different question. I was thinking about this, too, before you came on and sort of during our chat here. The government people, they only want to tell the president what the president wants to hear. The president doesn't want to have bad news. So you've got this self-reinforcing circle of distortion, disillusionment, rationalization, whatever it is, it's dysfunctional. Okay. But it seems to me that our private companies seem to be doing very good research. You know, if you look at opposition research, you look at Hillary Clinton's machine, when they looked into Trump, they spied on him. They created entire, you know, fake dossiers. They created, they lied to the FISA court. They're really good at spying on him. Okay. So when they want to, you know, we can get some good people to do that. But they did it privately. They didn't. That wasn't even though they were using government people, that obviously wasn't an official government function. So I'm thinking, you know, the opposition research, when the cancel culture goes into somebody's life, you know, they analyze every last little detail. They talk to their, you know, their first girlfriend when they were, you know, 14 years old, or boyfriend or whatever. But they really analyze people like crazy. Would we be better off? This is kind of a crazy question. Taking like really good investigative reporters and turn them loose and have government fund them and say, let's see what you can find out, you know, on who Xi Jinping is, you know, and there must be some, you know, fluent Chinese reporters in our country, probably Chinese American, that maybe could just do all kinds of great stuff and research and just analyze this like opposition research. I mean, they've got the money. The campaigns have the money to look at their opponents in excruciating detail. Why can't we use that same thing, you know, scrap the intelligence community because they're too locked into their disillusionment, and just get private people and see if they could be spies for us? Just a thought.
You know, I think that that's potentially a good idea. You know, I'm sufficiently dismayed with the intelligence community, you know, that I think a future president, this president, of course, can't be counted upon, but
president.
As far as okay, I mean, the agency, my alma mater is going to really hate this. But I could see it entirely justifiable to ban the CIA, to abolish it, to deconstruct it. It's one of the things. You know, Kennedy, after the agency failed him in the Bay of Pigs, he almost did that. He almost decided to get rid of the CIA.
Okay.
And, you know, but given their involvement in, you know, this coup attempt against President Trump, you know, along with the FBI, I mean, I think both of those agencies, the FBI and the CIA, have crossed the line, you know, so badly that, you know, that their dissolution, you know, should have been seriously considered. You know, their technological capabilities and their actual spy masters and people like that. You know, the CIA isn't the only intelligence organization we have. We have the Defense Intelligence Agency, we've got the National Security Agency, and every military service has got its own intelligence agency. So it's not like by getting rid of them, you know, we would have no intelligence assets available to us. You know, maybe a demonstration to the deep state needs to be made, you know, by and not just a demonstration, but maybe that's an organic necessity if we somehow don't become a totalitarian system under the Biden administration ourselves, and somehow get a second shot at restoring our constitutional republic. Let me go back to your other question.
Sure.
Okay, because I think one way of answering it, you know, let me give you an example of the kind of personality that you have in totalitarian and authoritarian type systems. And that might be, you know, you take somebody like Yuri Andropov, who had been the premier of the Soviet Union back in the early 1980s. You know, he was Ronald Reagan's counterpart in the Soviet Union and was the guy who almost nuked us during the 1983, Able Archer 83 exercise. But who was Yuri Andropov? According to the press at the time, you know, that was beating up on Ronald Reagan and hated Ronald Reagan's military buildup, Yuri Andropov was a man we could deal with. That he was according to the Washington Post and the New York Times, he liked jazz. You know, he was fond of things Western. A man we could negotiate with and deal with. Okay, that's what they were reporting. But now, in retrospect, and actually we knew it at the time. The press didn't know it at the time, but it was known at the time that he was actually a killer, like all these people were. You know, when he was a young man, he was a commissar. In the aftermath of World War II, he was in charge of re-education and advancing communism in the Baltic states. And he got that position by killing off political rivals, so that he was the top guy by the time the war ended, you know, in that part of the world. In the 1950s, he was the guy that he had risen up so that he was put in charge in the aftermath of the Hungarian Revolution. He was put in charge of sorting that all out. And he got the nickname of being the Butcher of Hungary, you know, because he had executed, you know, thousands of Hungarian patriots who had revolted against the Warsaw Pact and domination by the Soviet Union. But that's the kind of guy he was. And he was extremely paranoid as a consequence, you know, because you can't help but be paranoid in a totalitarian system, because even your closest buddies, it's like being in the mafia, you know, might, if they can displace you and take over your position by killing you or disgracing you or something like that, they'll do it. Premier of the Soviet Union, he was one of those that was responsible for this program called the Varian program, the surprise nuclear missile attack program, because he was convinced that Reagan was going to launch a surprise nuclear attack against the Soviet Union, or that some future president would, but it could be Reagan, and that the proximity to nuclear war was so very near that they had to do things like watch the lights in the Pentagon and keep track of pizza deliveries and the blood bank donations, and the price of gold. All these, there were thousands of indicators that they were looking at, you know, for evidence that the United States might be getting ready to strike us under the Vrayon program. And so when we had the theater nuclear exercise called Able Archer 83, which was the first time we introduced Pershing 2 intermediate range missiles into Europe, which could reach Moscow from Europe, that was perceived as the reverse of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had no idea about this. We thought we were just balancing, and we told the Soviets that the reason we had to do that was because they were deploying SS-20s at a rate of one a week. They were the first ones to introduce this new category of missile called the intermediate range nuclear missile, so they could fight and win a nuclear war in Europe. And we couldn't let them do that. It would even threaten to do that. The mere threat to do that would decouple and undermine the credibility of our security guarantees to NATO. So we had to do something to balance that. And the P-2s and the GLICKMs, ground-launched cruise missiles, were one of the least provocative things we thought we could do that would restore credibility and maintain our nuclear credibility. But they saw that as possible preparation, that this was it. The balloon had gone up, and we were going to launch this nuclear attack. And it came very close, you know. One of the only reasons we didn't get into a nuclear war with the Soviet Union during that period, fortunately, you know, is Andropov died of kidney failure, you know, and took him off the scene. But that's the kind of personality. That's not untypical. That's how most of these guys are. And God looks after fools, little children in the United States. And we got an atypical leader of the Soviet Union in Gorbachev, you know, which is why one of the main reasons the Cold War ended, we were able to prevail and win the Cold War without it going nuclear, because Gorbachev was in charge. And he hadn't even known, you know, they needed a young leader, and he was a true believer in communism and all of that. But in a benign, you know, the smiley face version of socialism that our academics believe in. And he himself was appalled with his own military and intelligence services as we would be in a lot of ways. So we got very lucky in that we got somebody in at the top of the Soviet system towards the end of the Cold War that helped, you know, Reagan's strategy win. I mean, at the end of the day, it was the combination of luck getting Gorbachev, but also the hard-headed, realistic approach to foreign and defense policy pursued by Ronald Reagan, the peace through strength policy, that worked that miracle. And it was a miracle, you know, because I don't think that I can't think of a precedent in history where you had two superpowers locked in death grips, where the thing ended without a world war, where one side prevailed basically peacefully.
How is Gorbachev? I got two more questions. I got about 2 minutes left to see if I can get them both in. How is Gorbachev looked upon in Russia today?
He's considered a traitor, and you know, by almost everybody, which is why he doesn't live in Russia anymore. As a matter of fact,
He's still alive. I thought he passed on. I guess
he is alive.
Okay.
No,
where is he now?
I think he's still alive. I'm not sure. You know, I think he moves around Europe. You know. Occasionally
he was in San Francisco.
Pardon?
I used to go by his house when I was a tour guide in San Francisco. I used to drive by his house in the Presidio. He had this international center for several years. Yeah, I don't know where he is now, though.
I don't either. I wouldn't be surprised if he's moving around to avoid assassination. I wouldn't be surprised if he was, you know, he might be on Putin's hit list.
Yeah. Well, if he's looked upon as a traitor, then we're not going to see Glasnost or Perestroika anytime soon, is what it sounds like. So here's my last question. If you're interested, when you mentioned getting rid of the FBI, which I've long wanted to do because, you know, we have nothing in our Constitution for a national police force, which is what they are. And if you're saying the CIA is basically functionally incompetent at this point, just because their ideology has taken over their brain. If you were to write an article to redesign our intelligence community, I don't even know if you can publish this based on your clearances and other things like that, but is that something that you would be interested in doing, in saying, if we really want to have a good intelligence community, if we want to be effective, this is what we need to do, and this is what the organization should be, or these are the organizations that should take over for the CIA. Would that be something you'd be interested in putting together? I'd be really curious what you think.
Well, I've already done it.
I wrote
a book for when I was on the professional staff. I co-authored Actually, I wrote the thing, ghost wrote the thing for a member of Congress, Kurt Weldon, a good friend of mine. It was called the Countdown to Terror. And half of the book is basically is recommendations for reforming the intelligence community.
Okay.
And I still think the recommendations included in that book are is the way to go.
I got the 10-second warning when you said it. We're actually out of time now, so just tell me the book one more time. I want to take a look at this, and then let's talk about this more next week. What was the book called one more time?
Countdown to Terror by Kurt Weldon.
Thank you, sir. What an incredible hour and a half. This has been wonderful. I'm glad that we were able to – you had this time available to really go over this subject. But we're literally off the air. I have to go. I will talk to you next week. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it, too. Bye-bye.
All right. Feel free to share this, too. Greg Penglis for Action Radio. Back tomorrow at 7 o'clock Central Time, 7 o'clock in the morning, at blogradio.com/citizenaction. What an amazing time. Wow.